off the ball.
Rugby.
It's the first time I've seen a real confidence and a swagger in their attack. Cohesion in passing and stuff, and that's quite telling.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
All right, welcome back to Off the Ball. And we are very excited to be joined this evening by Patrick Harding, who is the performance... Actually, I want to get this right. What exactly is your role?
Yeah, good question. I ask myself that a lot. If I'm messing about, I'll say I'm an au pair for a Formula One driver, but my technical title is a performance coach.
And it is for Alex Albon, who is racing for Williams this year. He's been racing for Williams for the past few years. And you've been with him, with Alex Albon, for how long now?
This is year eight.
You're eight.
I said, wow. I would do three, and here we are.
Yeah. So, like, thank you so much for finding the time to chat to us. You know, the Formula One season is starting again next week. How hectic is your schedule right now, so close to the beginning of the new season?
Yeah, it's been pretty intense. I mean, the new regulations coming in meant that we had three tests this year. One unofficial in terms of that behind closed doors in Barcelona, and then two in Bahrain over the last 2 weeks. Normally we would have one test. So we do a training camp pre-season every year, and this year we were on training camp on the 28th of December. So yeah, wow. It was a quick turnaround considering that we've probably shut the laptop on the 18th of December. So it's come around quick. There's obviously been a lot going on in the team. I mean, I think that's with every team right now. We've had 2 weeks in Bahrain, back for a week and then out to Australia next week. So yeah, once you hit that pre-season training camp, it's kind of all go. There's not really a window where it stops between kind of getting that work done early season and then marketing and commercials kicking off. But obviously a lot of work from an engineering point of view, and then you're prepping for tests. So yeah, there's not a lot of time to breathe, that's for sure.
No, especially with like an elongated calendar. I mean, I'm sure when you started in F1 kind of 8 years ago, there was, what, like 20 races a season, and now we're up to 24.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, you're probably right. I think it was 18 or 19 races at the start. And the last two seasons, we've had the earliest start and the latest finish in kind of F1 calendar history. So it's pretty relentless. And I think that you see that through the teams now. Some roles are rotatable and some aren't, you know. So the more races that go on the calendar, obviously the more pressure it puts on the system. So But that's the job, right? And you know, from a driver point of view, from somebody like me who's working as a performance coach, you know what you're signing up to. So you can't work in F1 and then complain about travel. That's just the reality of the role. And when I have conversations with people inside the sport, and that's the route to go down, I shut it off straight away, because everything you do is a choice. And I've made the choice to be in this role right now. And I still love it. And that's why I'm here. But it doesn't mean that it comes with a lot of sacrifice.
Exactly. And kind of touching on your role specifically, because you have a very interesting story. But I suppose I want to ask initially, so you're a performance coach, but how does that differ from, say, a personal trainer? Like, what's the difference in that role?
Yeah, I mean, probably 8 years of university and 16 years in elite sport.
Yeah.
So I started life as a chartered physiotherapist, did applied physiology, went into physiotherapy, spent about 7-8 years working in elite sport as a physiotherapist, went to a couple of Olympic Games, worked in professional rugby, AFL, worked at Arsenal Football Club, did my master's in strength and conditioning, started to incorporate that into my work, took on an Irish boxer, Michael Conlon, and an Irish golfer, Paul Dunn, started to really enjoy working with individuals, the kind of level of detail that you could get into compared to working in a squad-based sport. I just felt that kind of at that point in my career, the volume was becoming a little bit too much in terms of just where I wanted to be as a practitioner. And I mean, there's practitioners in team sports who do incredible jobs, but I was looking for a little bit of a change. And then when I started working with Michael and Paul, I just really loved that individual aspect. A bit more time looking at performance gain, individual development, personal development, relationship building. And then just out of blue, an opportunity came up through Twitter, of all places.
Oh, wow.
At the time. Yeah, exactly. It was a random one. Just got a DM one day from somebody saying, you know, being recommended you, your skill set and your experience is what we're kind of looking for. Didn't have a clue. He was like, are you open to having a conversation? I said, absolutely. Always am. Always keen to hear about new opportunities. It turned out it was a company from Finland who supply coaches to drivers in Formula 1, Formula 2. But I did four rounds of interviews, had no idea what the job was.
Really?
Pretty intense, yeah. Until the last interview, when kind of had an interview with their head of performance, and at the end of the interview, he was like, Obviously, for confidentiality reasons, we couldn't disclose who you'd be working with or who we'd potentially be putting you with, but it's in Formula One, Formula Two. And they offered me a Formula One role that year, but I'd never worked in motorsport before. And I'd already committed to Michael and Paul for that season. So they came back to me with a role in Formula Two. And actually, that was the year that Alex was in Formula Two with George and Lando.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it was a really, really incredible F2 season. But I was actually working with a driver called Tadasuka Makino, who's a Japanese driver. He was on the Honda Dream program at the time. He had a really good season and he went back to do Super Formula, Super GT in Japan. And then Alex got the call to go to Toro Rosso and he didn't have a coach. And we'd kind of gotten to know each other a little bit through that season. His best friend was another Japanese driver, Nere Fukuzumi, who's also in Super GT and Super Formula in Japan. And I just kind of got to know Alex by being in that group. Mm. So yeah, when he got the call, he was looking for a coach and I was one of the names that was kind of recommended to him. And obviously he knew me, so we sat down and had a conversation about our philosophies, how we would want to work together. I kind of knew that he was the kind of individual that I would want to work with. We did a trial session together and like I said, that's 8 years ago.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I wanted to ask about how important it is to get that dynamic right. And did you kind of know immediately this is somebody I could see myself working with alongside for what is now becoming 8 years?
Yeah, look, for me initially, I'm looking for that belief set and the value set. And when you've been around them for a season, even at a distance, and you understand a little bit about his story, you know that he's got the right belief set and value set to be successful. Mm. And seeing how he interacted with people, seeing how people spoke about him when he wasn't around, you could tell he was a good human being. And for me, those two were like non-negotiables in terms of anybody that I'm going to work with. And once we started working together, like then you go to really simple things like similar sense of humor, like similar food. It's like being in a relationship. But fundamentally, we have the same value in core value set, which is honesty, integrity, respect, hard work, commitment, positive intentions. So the stuff that we needed to align on, we aligned really, really well. And that's the stuff that's built the longevity through the relationship. You know, we said off air, I'm not really a motorsport fan. I have a huge respect for what they do. I think what those guys and girls do in the car is absolutely incredible. When you actually really sit down and think about what they do and the margins that they deliver at, it's mind-blowing.
A certain type of person.
Absolutely.
To sit down in those cars and to kind of do what they do week in, week out.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the margins that they do, we'll probably talk a little bit about that as well. But I kind of knew that, like I said, those core values were similar. And yeah, look, we've been on a journey together. You know, the individual he is now in terms of his maturity and his experience and his understanding of his own performance philosophy and the handle that he has on his own identity as a human being, but also as a sports person, has put him in such a really good platform. And we've seen that in his performances over the last 3 or 4 years.
Especially, I was looking at last season's result for Williams. I mean, an eighth place finish in the Drivers' Championship, yeah. The highest of the midfield teams,
yeah.
Kind of pushing the team forward. You would look at Williams in the past 10 years and the kind of difference in perhaps George Russell's final season at that mm-hmm. team versus kind of the results that Albon could pull out in qualifying.
Yeah.
It was a fantastic watch from kind of sitting at home, watching on the television, from sitting kind of backstage at the Grand Prix.
Yeah.
It must have been such a rewarding season.
It's, you do your best to not be outcome focused, right? And
okay.
at a Williams, when it's difficult, that's even more important than ever because we laugh. There's race weekends. There was one in Baku about 3 years ago when clearly the team were struggling. We weren't even a mid-pack team. So a good weekend looked very different than it did last year. He qualified, and this sounds stupid to say, but he qualified 14th in quali and then he finished 13th in the race. And we reflect on that as one of his most perfect weekends because there wasn't one tenth he didn't squeeze out of the car. And he executed phenomenally across all of the structures that we'd built around his performance. He just absolutely nailed. And we both reflect on that weekend. But then he gets out of quali, out of car, and the garage is silent because we're not out of Q2. And then you finish the race in P13 and you don't even get a look in because obviously, you know, they want to speak to the people who finished in the top 10. But actually for us, that was as perfect as it gets. So you have to step away from that outcome focused. what we had built into our performance structure was recognizing that at Williams at that time, opportunity didn't come around very often. So you always needed to be switched on. Whether that was, you know, a lucky incident in front of you, a lucky red flag, a lucky yellow flag, you know, whatever that is, some rain. Mm-hmm. To be able to demonstrate your ability at a Williams, you need to be ready for those opportunities when they come along. And he had some phenomenal drives across that season. His second year at Williams, he drove the team to P7. He got 26 out of 27 points that year. And he was teammate with Logan. And Logan arguably had a bit of an unlucky year that year. I don't think his time in F1 really reflected how good a driver he was. But Alex executed so well that year. I think he had 3 P7 finishes that year himself. So we try and step away from that from an outcome perspective and really focus on, what have you been asked to deliver? What have we agreed is your performance structure? And across a race weekend, how well do we commit to that? If there's an outcome, amazing. But there is always an outcome that you can reflect on, whether that's good or bad. And like I said, he's squeezed into a P10 and had a phenomenal weekend. And he's come away with P6s, P7s and been disappointed about not having more because he felt like he could have executed better. And that's a really good place to be. But for sure, you know, it had been a difficult couple of years there. You know, it was a rebuild process last year. Clearly, the team made a good step. It'll be interesting to see where it shuffles out. You know, it's been a challenge to the start of the year. I think the level of regulation change has put a lot of pressure on the smaller teams. And I think we've seen a little bit at Williams. So, yeah, look, it's going to be another bit of a journey this year. And we'll just have to see where we pan out in Melbourne, really.
In terms of the regulation changes, I mean, this is the biggest shift that a Formula mm-hmm. 1 is seeing in quite a few years. People are saying since 22, but I'd nearly go back as far as, say, yeah. Turbo Hybrid era starting.
Alex would say ever.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Because having driven the cars now, having gone through testing, based on kind of Alex's feedback and your own work, how different is your preparation compared to, is there a huge difference in how you're preparing?
Look, obviously I don't touch on the technical, right? He talks to me about it, but it's never anything I'm going to offer any advice on. You know, he explains it to me in terms of the different style in driving now. It's 50% electric, 50% combustion. So a lot of the success now in driving is around your battery management and your energy deployment. So it's a completely different style of driving, and all the drivers are saying that. So he described it really well to me, you know, last year and previously. You know, you build your car up to be as quick as possible in quali, and then the quickest driver got the best position because you just drove the car as quick as possible.
Yeah.
And that's dumbing it down as much as I possibly can. This year, if you're a mid-pack driver or driver who can really understand the battery and energy deployment, you could get yourself a pole. You could be Max Verstappen, not understand how to utilize that battery properly, and you could finish in P10. So now it's not just about being the quickest driver. And I mean, you can argue, right, understanding the machinery and getting the most out of machinery is being a driver. So you could argue that, well, that's the job. You know, the best drivers will learn how to do it the best. But it definitely is a massively different style of driving. And I'm not sure how much the drivers are enjoying it right now.
Yeah, because you obviously you take everything from testing with a pinch of salt when you're watching on from afar, especially we don't know which teams are sandbagging, which teams are going to turn up at Melbourne half a second quicker than perhaps we thought they would be. But even, you know, there's drivers like Max Verstappen comparing it to Formula E, which got a lot of press, but I think that was maybe overhyped a bit. But even drivers like Hamilton, who've been in the sport for so long, saying it's such a different experience.
Absolutely. And, you know, those guys have grown up like in you know, loving the 80s and 90s era into the early 2000s. And even this car was the last regulation change was a bit of a shift for everybody. And you speak to, you know, you hear people like Lewis and Max talk, you know, they'll always harp back to the sound of the V8s.
Yeah.
And the older guys in the garage and guys and girls in the garage who've been around a long time say there's nothing like that era. So change comes along and you have to adapt to it, and just where we're at right now, FIA have made that decision and we're here. I think what could be a shame is, you know, last year with the regulation change, it coming over a couple of years, it really closed up the field. You know, in Qatar last year, the difference in quali between P5 and P17 in Q1 was 0.2 seconds, and that's just so exciting. And for me as a performance coach, that is like the absolute epitome test for execution, which is no margin for error. Have we prepared well enough? Can you go and execute well enough? And I think what we'll see this year is could be 2 or 3 seconds at least between P1 and P22. I'm going to say P20, but there's obviously Cadillac
new,
now.
New teams.
It could be even more. And I think that'll be a shame if we see this really massive spread across the field. But I think it's going to be inevitable, certainly for this season, till teams get a handle on where they're at in terms of, you know, all the changes, both from an aero point of view, but also from a from an engine point of view. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting season. I think the obvious teams look quick.
That Ferrari rear wing is kind of the one that everyone's talking about. Whether it'll work, it looks cool.
It does look cool. Bit of Italian flair. like you said, how practical it's going to be and how much time it actually brings. But, you know, it when you get change like that, it provides an opportunity for teams to think a little bit outside the box and see what they come up with. So, yeah, it's certainly going to be a new experience, I think, both for the drivers and for the fans this year.
Yes, and you were speaking there about kind of the execution and kind of the milliseconds that takes. What most people find particularly interesting about Formula One is that it is a team sport, but your direct competitor is your teammate. Is there, even psychologically, is there a lot of competition between the two garages, and how do you manage that while still working with a larger team?
Yeah. This is a really good question. I mean, the age-old adage in Formula 1 is the only person you need to beat is your teammate. And that is the reality. And when it comes to the end of the season, if there's a seat up for grabs, the person who's the quickest is going to get that seat more often than not, unless you're someone who's got a lot of money. So that is absolutely the environment you're in. I think what Alex has always tried to do is have a good relationship, positive relationship with his teammates. And that's always been the case. And him and Carlos have a lot of respect for each other. And you can see that in terms of how they interact and how they discuss with each other aspects of car and performance. And you can see that. But it's one of those where it's very easy to bring it back to, it's still about you, irrespective of who you're racing, whether that's the guy across the garage from you or the team down the paddock. It's really all about what kind of time you can squeeze out of the car. And that always comes back to your individual performance. And over the years, we've developed, like I kind of mentioned it before, a really good performance structure, which links really well to Alex's personality, his values, how he believes he likes to drive, how he believes he drives at his best. And the challenge for us is, irrespective of what's going on around us, is trying to create that environment consistently, and then for him to be able to step into that and maximise his capacity within that structure that we create. So irrespective of where we're at in the championship, where we're at in a race, that is always our goal. Of course, it's hard not to look across the garage, or it's hard not to look down the paddock and be like, oh, we're 2 tenths from here, or we're 3 tenths ahead of this, or, you know, that's just the nature of sport. You know, they're competitors at the end of the day, and, you know, who wins is decided by who drives the fastest and who gets the most points. So ultimately, it is important. The job for me is to be able to bring him back to that space where it's literally just about him. And like I said, his self-awareness and his ability to connect with that is so important in terms of those performances, because when there is noise in the garage and there's noise in the team and there's noise in the paddock, being able to quieten that and for him to be able to step into that performance structure, we call it his flow state, for him to be able to access that is so important for his performance. And like I said, he's committed to that, and he does a really good job of accessing that as much as he possibly can.
Because he's had such a fascinating motorsports journey, because it's not been linear, kind of Toro Rosso to Red Bull and then out of the sport entirely for a year at DTM. Mm-hmm. Were you still with him at that stage?
Yeah, absolutely.
How much of a learning curve, or even to bounce back then into the sport and to be, I don't necessarily want to say better than ever, but he's now leading a team.
Absolutely.
And, you know, dragging a Williams car to an incredible finish last season.
Yeah.
How did those lessons help and to kind of make him become the driver that he is now going into this season?
Yeah. It's how you approach that year out, right? You know, relative to how drivers have done at Red Bull, Alex is arguably the one who's performed the best over the last 5-6 years. He probably just wasn't given enough time. Mm. He moved to Red Bull after 14 races as a rookie. Yes. You know, George and Lando the year before had done a ton of testing, had done a lot of FP1s. Alex's first time in an F1 car at Toro Rosso was the media day before testing. It's the first time he sat in a Formula One car. Yeah. So that trajectory was incredible. And when I think about the mental structures, the emotional structures that he's got right now, and reflect on where he was as a human being back then, of course it was going to be a challenge. It was a massive step in terms of the expectation of performance and the expectations he had for himself, and then the media on the outside. And if you look at George and Lando at that time, you know, the three of them were fighting for the F2 championship up until the last race of the season. George was at Williams, again, struggling at the time. He became known as Mr. Saturday, forget now, of Q1. Yeah. He had no pressure. Every weekend was a learning weekend. He had 2 or 3 years at Williams where he could grow as an individual, get used to the environment, learn technically, and then be ready for that opportunity at Mercedes. You know, McLaren were a bit better than that at the time. You know, Lando had Carlos as a teammate, somebody that he obviously connected with really, really well, was learning a lot from Carlos, who had a lot of experience. And McLaren were kind of in that mid-pack. So when Lando would have a good weekend and he'd get in the points, it was like, brilliant. And then if he didn't, there was nothing really said because they were kind of just floating in that mid-pack.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a lot of attention there. And Alex went from some like really good performances at Toro Rosso to stepping in at Red Bull. And then suddenly, if he wasn't in the top four, it was a disaster. So there was a huge shift there in terms of what the expectation was. And at that time, he dealt with it really well. And he put in a lot of work around both his technical development and also his emotional and his mental development as well. And when we got to the end of that second year at Red Bull, and we hadn't had a decision, but we kind of knew that he was probably going to lose his seat. And I asked him, like, how are you feeling? Like, and honestly, he was like, I felt like I left everything on the table. Mm. And for me as a performance coach, that's beautiful. Like, we got to the end of the year and he was like, of course there was stuff I would do differently now, but that's just hindsight and learning.
Yeah.
But he said, I felt like I gave it everything I could. So we got a decision, and then a couple of weeks later, we were sitting again. And I just wanted to hear him say it, but I knew what the answer was going to be. And I just said, what are your options? Because there was a lot of stuff floating around about Formula E and IndyCar. And yeah. I said, I just wanted to hear him say it out loud. And I said, what are your options? And he said, there's only one option, and that's Formula One. And that was it. We made that year about him getting a seat back. So yeah, he went to DTM. I can't say he particularly enjoyed it. But he had a couple of really good results at really opportune moments that brought him back into the spotlight. He was working as a reserve at Red Bull at the time, spent a lot of time at the factory with an incredible engineer called Simon Rennie. And his technical knowledge, the growth in his technical knowledge that year was exponential because he was just learning from some really good engineers in the sim.
Yeah.
He was spending 3 or 4 days a week in the sim. So you obviously would want them to have continued in that seat. But actually stepping out, the learning from an emotional point of view, the learning about his identity, having, you know, your dream kind of taken away and learning to deal with that, but then recognizing that, no, I'm going to get after it again, which is what he's done his whole career. And then all of the other aspects of the learning that he had around the technical side and the passion for his driving and his ability to kind of sit back and reflect a little bit about wanting to enjoy it more if he got the opportunity again, meant that when he stepped back at in at Williams, I'm not going to say he was a different individual because he's not, but he just had such a better handle on who he was as a person, but also how he wanted to perform in the environment, his handle on his own identity, and that, you know, you get a bit of a second chance and you don't want to let it slip. So, you know, he was always phenomenally committed to his development, but that evening, you know, the acceleration in that even was impressive. So, look, I wouldn't swap that year out for the world.
Yeah.
Wouldn't swap it for the world. Of course, I'd like them, you know, to have stayed in that team, you know, in terms of the opportunity for results. Mm. But the learning at Williams as well has been incredible. And like exactly like you said earlier, you know, he stepped in at the team and had to become a leader. And that was the right place for him to do that. And it was a really good opportunity and good timing in his career for him to take on that responsibility. And he's done that with class.
It's the leadership role that I'm kind of was interested in. That year nearly with Logan Sargeant, a younger kind of rookie driver, you are new to a team and you're the one who's being relied on to consistently bring back points. And I feel like when you're not in a team that's kind of consistently challenging for podiums, that can go overlooked.
Yeah.
The kind of pressure to consistently fight your way up to that kind of P10, P9, P8 space. How much of your job is psychological working with him?
I would say 80% of it now.
Okay.
80%. The physical stuff is easy. You know, it's 8 years in, he's conditioned to the car. We know exactly what it works from a conditioning point of view. His work ethic is incredible. He makes a direct correlation between his physical fitness and his platform to perform on track. So getting them to work is easy. Getting them to stop working is sometimes a challenge. So the physical stuff, and obviously we've, you know, developed our structure in terms of nutrition and sleep and travel over the last 8 years. And then we play around with the edges based on the research and we get experts to come in and look at what we do. But 80% of what we do is about managing the mental space when we're at a race weekend, or the challenges within the team or the environment from a political point of view, or supporting him with developing the right kind of relationships, or if there is a relationship that's a little bit challenging, you're mediating that, making sure that the stuff that he needs to work with engineers, there's a clear line of communication there and he's holding people accountable. You're the sounding board for all of that, and you're also a little bit of the strategy behind it as well. And you're that safe space for him to be able to come back and go, these are the challenges I'm having, what do we do next? And you're planning that. So yeah, I would say 80% of the work I do now is really mental and emotional management. And you know, 8 years in, you know, we know more about each other than most of our families probably know about us. So there's that level of trust and honesty, you know. It's the balance between that, like, nurturing and the challenge, right? It's no good being a yes man. He doesn't need a yes man. There's plenty of people in the space who are going to do that. What he comes to me for is honesty. And I'll give him the same consistency of energy, whether we have a good weekend or a bad weekend.
Yeah.
If we have a good weekend and there's stuff that we missed out on, I'll challenge him on that. If we have a bad weekend, but I think he's executed really well, then I'll be quick to highlight that. And I would expect the same from him. And I think that's why the relationship is still so productive, because there's that level of trust and honesty in the relationship behind it. But also there's the openness to challenge each other when we're holding each other accountable to what our roles are. And he's always open to being held accountable. Mm. It's the work we've had to do is him actually looking at externally sometimes, because at the start, the self-reflection became quite negative because it just would go so far.
Yeah.
And now we're in a place where he can recognize what is his controllable and what somebody else's, and somebody else needs to own that. So yeah, being able to, like, be in that space with him and challenge him in those ways is probably the key to the relationship.
And I suppose it's something that can only happen when you've been working with somebody for so long. Because that was, we were kind of talking before we were on air about Formula One is so interesting. You have people who are, say, a race engineer and the driver who are working together for years and have, like, nearly a shorthand with each other. And then you were saying there's also kind of relationships that's chopping and changing the whole time. So I think the benefit there for a driver having a performance coach through three different teams now in a year off, I'm sure is, would that be unique?
I think it's more unique. Mm. Yeah, I mean, when, funny, Max's coach, Rupert Manwaring, is one of my closest friends in motorsport. We laugh, we're like the old guard now, and we bounce around a couple of teams with our drivers. And I think what change is obviously difficult and challenging, and there's opportunity there as well. But when a driver changes, drivers are a funny breed, right? They like what they like most sports people, right? They like consistency. They like knowing that they have a routine that works. So when you bring a performance coach from one team to another, you're just recreating the same performance structure in another environment.
Yeah.
So you can trust that individual to develop as much as you possibly can that you've had previously that you know works. There's always stuff that you can improve on. And you may do that in a newer team where there's better resources or there's different places that you can go for those resources. But to have that consistency move with you is really important. Now, and again, we talked about before, like, you know, what's the closest role that you can think of, like golf caddy, right? Like it's, you know, some caddies change and some don't. And that just depends on how good the relationship is. And, you know, for us right now, it still works. And while it's still working and it's still productive and I can still provide the same challenge for him and he still feels he needs that challenge, then I think the relationship will continue.
And it's not just, I mean, you're not just rocking up to a race weekend as Alex Albon's performance coach. You're very much involved in Williams kind of on multiple levels. Like, what would your kind of other roles be in this team?
Yeah, so I'm the performance lead for their young driver program. So we've got 9 junior drivers this year from Luke Browning in Super Formula right down to a couple of kids who've joined the karting structure last year, 11 years of age. They're in OK Junior. So we have 9 junior drivers and I supply all of the performance services. So performance coaches, performance nutrition, psychology, medical services. And then I link our performance-based services with the engineering services at Williams. And I also run the pit stop development program at the team as well. So yeah, team physio, pit stop coach, on track and then a pit stop coach at the factory. We've also got secured 2 PhDs to come in and work with our pit stop program. They're hopefully starting in the summer. So yeah, it's development work around different aspects of performance within the team, from both Alex as an individual to our academy structure, and then also the pit stop program.
Am I correct in saying as well that you're currently doing a PhD in DCU? Yeah. And what's that in?
Yeah, so the broad title is Elite Sports Performance. I'm doing a qualitative look at driver journey. So naturally, being in the roles that I'm in, I'm super keen in looking at, do we provide young drivers with the right environments to be successful? And how do the environments we put them in affect their performances, really? So, and a classic example is, you know, even with football, if you want to make it relatable to more people, you know, player moves to a team, big money move, because their performance have been good, to go into the team and it just doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? And then they move to another team and their form comes back. That's about environment. That's not about the individual. The talent doesn't change. The ability doesn't change. The ability to perform changes. Mm. So, you know, we've had a couple of interesting things over the last couple of years with drivers that we've placed in different teams in Formula 2 and Formula 3, and then gotten in reverse ways, but unexpected performances, and then, you know, performances that we were thinking, oh, that should have been better.
Yeah.
And then it's then you start thinking, well, why is that happening? And, you know, we have a massive responsibility as a team to help support these young drivers achieve their dream. And that works, you know, that is just as important to us as a team as it is to the young drivers, because, you know, they drive for Williams, and if we can get more drivers into Formula One, then we've done a good job. So their development and the return on the investment from a team point of view, but also the drivers actualizing their potential as individuals and as drivers, is absolutely our focus. So to do a doctorate in that made sense at the time. It's difficult to squeeze it in, but luckily DC are very understanding.
And because it's interesting what you say, you know, the success is getting drivers to Formula One to a certain extent, I'd agree, but how is there a point where you're saying, actually, this young driver we've been developing, I could really see them doing well in endurance racing,
absolutely,
in something else. Do you guide them towards that? Or is it difficult to say to somebody who's in karting, we don't think that you can, we would recommend perhaps something else?
I think a karting is probably too young to do that.
Yeah.
But certainly by the time they get to Formula 3, you're already assessing whether or not they're good enough for Formula 1. Or, and that's sorry, I should rephrase that, because that's probably not correct. You're looking to see if you think they have the attributes as an individual and as a driver to make it to Formula 1, because, you know, maturity comes along and understanding comes along and self-awareness or the right environment, and suddenly performances improve a lot. Or they get in the right car that suits their driving style and they've got the right engineer who understands them as a driver, and then suddenly things can click. And the margins are so small, it doesn't take a lot for that to happen. You know, you look at our F2 season when we had Zach O'Sullivan and Franco Colapinto in the cars. Mm. And, you know, Franco went to MP and Zach went to ART. And ART are traditionally a top two, top three, Formula 2, Formula 3 team. And for whatever reason, they just couldn't get a handle on the car that year. And Zach, who was probably our number one Formula 2 driver at the time, had a difficult season. Him and Victor Martins were in the same team.
Yes.
And then Franco, MP, seemed to be able to get it together. And Franco had some really good performances, got a couple of podiums. And then when Logan left the seat, Franco got the call.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, at the start of the year, if you had to put a bet on somebody getting to Formula 1 from within the team, it might have been Zach. But actually, the environment produced these opportunities for two individuals, and Franco was able to demonstrate what he was capable of, and he got the opportunity and obviously took that opportunity. So there are these sliding doors moments, but we need to understand that, and we need to put drivers in environments where we're maximising their potential for being successful. And exactly that might be WEC. You know, WEC is an incredible category. It might be IMSA. It might be IndyCar. It might be Formula E. You know, and you're probably guilty, and I've kind of probably alluded to it in my language when I shouldn't, which is, you can think that Formula One is like the only place that you can go. But drivers have had incredible careers in other sports. Look at somebody like Carlos Sr., right? Like, he's a legend in motorsport because of his rallying career. So
I always think to Robert Kubica and what he managed to do outside of Formula One since the case of his accident, but then coming back and still having an incredible season.
Absolutely. So yeah, I think probably the challenge for Williams right now is we don't have those really well-established routes into other categories, like maybe a McLaren or like maybe other teams within the paddock. But I think that's where Williams want to go. They want to have a program that produces very talented drivers who can go into categories and be successful, not just Formula One.
So obviously, pre-season testing is kind of finished now. We're looking ahead to the first race of the season in Australia. Williams perhaps didn't have the best start to testing. What's the vibe like at Williams right now, but how do you stay motivated when perhaps you're not as optimistic as you would have been a few weeks ago?
Yeah, look, you probably have to lean on some of the old strategies that we had from our early days at Williams, which are, we're not really sure where we're at. We're probably not where we want to be, but that's okay. We demonstrated in testing we've got a reliable car, so there's going to be opportunity there. I think not everybody was able to demonstrate that. We've just got to bed down and learn and try and learn quick and try and make changes quick. And I don't think that's any different than where we've been in the start of any season. Okay, you know, we won't really know until Saturday in quali in Melbourne where we actually sit against everybody else right now. But it's been such a huge regulation change. I think for a team like Williams, who's still on that growth journey, it was just another challenge at a time, you know, which exposed probably some of the old strategies that we had as a team. But I think, you know, we obviously would have liked to meet in Barcelona. The team took the decision not to. We got to Bahrain. You know, we just got to keep learning, got to keep focusing on where we need to develop as a team and as a factory, try and put our two drivers in the best car possible this year and continue to learn. I mean, yeah, of course, it would have been nice to leave Bahrain thinking that we were in the top four. That's probably not the case, but that's okay. Sport's difficult. It's supposed to be. That's why it's elite sport. So, yeah, it's more about how we respond as a team than kind of where we're at right now. And I think that's the most of the people that we have in the garage right now, most of the people that we have at the factory are kind of in that mindset, right? You don't click your fingers and suddenly you're competitive for the championship. We're still on that journey. And I think last year proved that we made some really good steps as a team, and hopefully throughout this season that we can make some good steps as well.
Yeah. I know you mentioned that Baku race a few years ago was one that you thought was an incredible weekend for Alex himself. Mm. But I can't let you go without asking what your favourite race has been that you've kind of been able to watch.
Favourite race?
Because Alex has had some mega drives over the years.
Yeah, it would be hard to pick one. I'll give you a selection. Quali is my favourite session of the weekend.
Really?
As a performance coach, yeah. Because it's the purest form of performance within the sport. Car is at its max. Driver has to be dialed in. Mm. Every session, you've got two opportunities to deliver the perfect lap. Go and deliver it under pressure.
Yeah.
So probably my favourite results have been qualifying more. There was a really standout quali he did at Toro Rosso where he got a P7 in Silverstone, and that was phenomenal. He's had a couple of P4. He had a P4 in Zandvoort a couple of years ago, which was amazing.
Yeah.
When he had moved to Red Bull, his first Suzuka, which is like an old school racing circuit.
Love Suzuka.
Yeah, he matched Max in quali. They were joint P2, P3, but Max had put his time in first, so he got P2. Mm. That was just an incredible lap. And then he's had a couple of qualies. Race-wise, you know, his first podium in Mugello was really special.
Yeah.
Really, really special. You know, he'd had two unfortunate instances where Lewis gently nudged him off track when he was, you know, probably due a podium and a race win. And that was difficult. So to kind of get that off his back and get that podium in Mugello and then follow that up in another one in Bahrain was really special as well. He had a P7 in Montreal a couple of years ago at the start of that season where we finished P7 in a championship where people didn't really know where we were. And you know, we talk about that leadership, right? It's people want to see us moving forward. And I think we had a difficult start to the season. We didn't get any points in the first few races. And then we went to Melbourne and he just had this phenomenal drive on Sunday. And I think he held up Esteban behind him and for about 21 laps where it was literally one DRS straight. And unless Alex was perfect for 21 laps, Esteban would have got him and he couldn't get him. Yeah. And that's one of Alex's, his, just that knowing Esteban was on his tail and just knowing I can't make a mistake here. And he's not even thinking that. It's not, he doesn't ever drive behind, he drives in front. So he's like, if I deliver this lap time every lap, he's not getting past me, and he did. And that was a phenomenal drive.
Yeah, like defensive driving, I think it's underrated in Formula One sometimes because it's not always the spectacle.
Yeah.
But I think back to something like Esteban Ocon's Hungary race victory, holding off Sebastian Vettel for something like 30 or 40 laps.
Yeah.
It's a magical watch, and when it's done well, like Alex did that day, yeah, it can be something very special to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Like it's when you think about it, you know, I could go on, you know, probably the things that make me proudest are actually the conversations we've had, moments where he's demonstrated real maturity or understanding or learning, and he's asked me some really good questions, or he's been willing and wanting to go into areas of his own performance that are difficult for him, but he knows that it's going to make him better. As a performance coach, there are the really proud moments. I think it's Miami this year. He becomes Williams' longest serving driver. He beats, I think it's Nigel Mansell is ahead of him. There's another driver ahead of him as well, but in Miami he becomes Williams' longest serving driver, which is pretty incredible.
It's some really mega names to be kind of over, leapfrogging there.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
There was a race this year where he became third in the list, and then in Miami he equals the record. He equals Nigel in Saudi, and then if he makes it to Miami, then he takes over as the longest serving driver at Williams.
And is there a race you're particularly looking forward to this season? Or like what race tracks do you kind of like going to? I know you said you weren't maybe a motorsports fan growing up, but by now you must have your favourites.
Yeah, absolutely. I like the old school tracks where there's really true. Like, I love Japan. I love the culture in Japan. Suzuka's just an old school circuit.
I love
the fans are incredible. That's really cool. You know, being in Monza with the Ferrari fans is intense, but it's cool. Austin's a really cool race week.
Okay.
It's a really good city. On the grid, it's probably one of the coolest turn ones when you look up and there's about 20,000 people wrapping around turn one. So that's a pretty iconic one. But Spa is beautiful as well. The setting is incredible. I mean, it always rains, but it's a beautiful setting.
I think it's, rotating with Barcelona from next season, which is a shame because for people, you know, for fans of motorsport who like the likes of Silverstone, your Spas, your Suzukas, see one of them going to rotating.
Yeah, that's like Silverstone's iconic. There's a few iconic tracks where you're in the presence of racing history when you're there, and you know the fans that turn up are like true racing fans.
Yeah, I got lashed on at Silverstone qualifying a couple of years ago. Absolutely drenched.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, general admission. Actually, speaking of getting drenched and horrible weather, do you find yourself back in Ireland much? Or
try to. Yeah. All my family are still here. I'm based in London. I've been in London for 16 years.
Wow.
But I try and at least get two separate weeks in Ireland. Ireland will always be home and more than likely somewhere where I'll end up. But within the race calendar, it's kind of popping back for a day here and there. It's always good to have an excuse to come home. But just anytime I can get a chance to get back, I do. It's just really difficult. You know, we probably do anything between 70, 75 flights a year. So when you have a week where you're not flying, kind of the last thing you want to do is jump on another plane.
But, yeah, exactly.
But no, I love getting home. All my closest friends are here and obviously family's still here. So yeah, it's good to get back when I can.
Yeah, so well, thank you very much for choosing to let us be one of your pit stops.
Pun intended.
No pun intended. Pun very much intended.
Very much intended.
So listen, best of luck for the season. Best of luck to Alex for the season. And hopefully we'll chat to you again sometime. This has been a very interesting conversation. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Perfect.
Off the Ball Daily.